The state of higher education in the U.S. has changed dramatically since the end of World War II.
Higher education virtually shut down during those years and then had to be recreated after the war.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, 75 years of American higher ed. We'll also talk about two colleges partnering for a nursing degree and spend an academic minute learning to apologize because apparently we really stink at it. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. American higher education is nearly four centuries old, but in the decades after World War II, as government and social support surged and enrollments exploded, the role of colleges and universities in American society changed dramatically. Dr. Roger Geiger details the ups and downs of those 75 years in his new book, American Higher Education Since World War II, A History. Roger Geiger is an emeritus distinguished professor of higher education at Penn State. I spoke to Professor Geiger about his book, which is kind of a continuation of an earlier book he wrote on American higher ed from the founding to World War I.
Well, I've been writing about the history of American higher education and teaching it for something like 35 years. And at the end, I really wanted to write a comprehensive history, which I felt it didn't exist. I thought I could do it in one volume, but when I reached 500 pages, I said, I better publish that and start over on the second volume.
Why was World War II the border point there?
Well, it was quite a demarcation for everything in American society, but higher education virtually shut down during those years and then had to be recreated after the war. And was fundamentally changed. It took a little bit of time, but eventually it emerged as a much stronger and more important institution. Before 1940, higher education, universities were important in some ways. They were important for the professions, for certain areas of knowledge. But after 1945, and particularly after 1960, they were recognized as being central institutions of our society. They were written about by people like Clark Kerr and Daniel Bell and John Kenneth Galbraith, Peter Drucker, all identified this change that had taken place in American society and the now central role of universities and higher education.
What most people would say was probably, the GI Bill probably made that change happen. Is that, in fact, what did happen?
The GI Bill had a kind of demographic effect. It brought a lot of people to college to graduate who otherwise would not have, particularly because of the war. It didn't change universities very much. Colleges and universities packed the GIs in and tried to get them through as fast as possible. And they basically wanted to go to the status quo, but there were other things that changed. So it was when by the time the GIs left in the 1950s, then this modern evolution really took off.
In the book, you talk a lot about how the Cold War and the Red Scare affected really the early years after the war in higher education and most of American life for that matter. Talk about how that did affect the higher ed in the U.S.
Well, the book is divided into four different eras in which the role of higher education, its relationship to American society, and its dynamics really changed markedly. The first is, I call the American way of life, which was just a very popular phrase from the late 1940s through the 1950s. And America was noted for its conservatism at that point. Conservative in the way people lived, the highest rate of marriage, the highest fertility of women, highest church going, and all these things persisted through the 1950s into the 1960s. So the Red Scare, McCarthyism, happened at the beginning of this period, and it sort of cast a pall over higher education. It prevented the expression of liberal ideas. And after the end of McCarthyism, McCarthy was censured in 1954, and then in, for the later 1950s, these liberal ideas become more prominent. And then a big change takes place at the end of the 50s and into the 1960s.
And in fact, you do quote a couple of historians calling that era from 57 to 68 the liberal hour. What does that mean, the liberal hour?
Well, all you have to do is look at the legislation that Lyndon Johnson pushed through in 1964 and 1965, which was sort of the culmination politically of that era. But this gradual growing liberal consensus, which, as I said, it kind of emerged in the late 1950s, led to a golden age for higher education. I call it the academic revolution. That's not my phrase, but it's very apt, because there was really a revolutionary change in the basic material and theories in all the academic departments and disciplines. In the sciences, the federal government poured money into basic research as never before and greatly developed the sciences. But the changes in the social sciences were just as revolutionary, and even in the humanities, even in history, the subject that I took my doctorate in, there were new theories, new interpretations. It was a very exciting time. At the same time, higher education was expanding greatly. So this was a golden age of expansion and intellectual advancement.
How important was Sputnik in the advancement of education in the U.S.?
Sputnik was a catalyst. It occurred right at this moment in the later 1950s, 1957 actually, when the pressure of McCarthyism had lifted, when the liberal ideas were becoming more prominent. And basically there was kind of a tug of war, particularly with respect to research in particular. But research was dominated by the Defense Department, and people, scientists and universities, were saying that this is the wrong way to fund research. We need to fund research for its own sake, and particularly basic research. And the military was saying, well, we don't want to fund basic research. We want to build weapons.
Yeah.
So there was this sort of stalemate. And then Sputnik broke the stalemate, basically. There was a consensus in the country that we had fallen behind in science and education, and that we needed to increase our investments in those areas. And it accelerated over time and reached a kind of crescendo with the legislation of the Great Society in 1964 to 66.
There was an awful lot going on in American society in the 60s, and especially in college campuses towards the end of the decade. What effect to higher education did the student unrest of the 60s have?
Well, it sort of signaled the end of this golden age. It called into question everything that was going on in universities, particularly the dedication to research, the preparation for careers. And basically, it challenged this notion of the American way of life. And the student critique said that the American way of life had given us segregation, it was given us the Vietnam War, and so forth. That was a very powerful critique. The student unrest changed life on campus in a lot of ways. The so-called parietal rules by which people in dormitories had hours and so forth, had to dress for dinner, all these things were abolished. But the more consequential changes came after that. The student unrest sort of broke the confidence that the government and much of American society had in higher education. And hence, from 1970, roughly 1970 on, you have a willingness to challenge universities and to advocate some far-reaching changes. This is the third era after the golden age or the liberal hour. I call it the unraveling because it unraveled many of the assumptions that had dominated this previous time.
One of the things, the biggest changes, though, you talk about was the amount of women who started going into college and universities during the late 60s and all through the 70s.
That's right. I call that section The Rise of Women. And there was an extraordinary increase in the influence of women and feminism on campus at the beginning of the 1970s. Feminism grew in the 1960s, but it really didn't take off until 1970. And it had tremendous political support behind it. I mean, the Republicans voted for the Equal Rights Amendment. They supported affirmative action. And ultimately, the higher education legislation that included Title IX, which gave equality to women. So there were really about three different things going on here. Throughout the 1960s, women had gradually been increasing their rate of attendance compared with men. During the 1950s, there was three men for every two women. And gradually, this became closer to equality in the 1960s, although men still were the majority. One big difference was the availability of jobs for women in the workforce. Many women didn't go to college because there was little point to it. But as job openings opened up for women, more and more went. And one of the most important effects of Title IX, which outlawed any sex discrimination in universities, was it gave women access to graduate and professional programs. I mean, women had access to higher education before that, but usually in law schools, medical schools, there were quotas. And pretty much the same thing in graduate education as well.
Still to come, our conversation with Professor Roger Geiger continues with a look at the current state of American higher ed. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Roger Geiger, an emeritus distinguished professor of higher education at Penn State. We're talking about his new book called American Higher Education Since World War II, A History. I asked him if the state of higher ed today has a lot to do with the student loan situation.
Yeah, the whole financial system that emerged, and I call the current era the period since 1980. And it's a remarkable period because the major forces that were put into play in and after 1980 have remained dominant to this day. That's almost four decades, which is much longer than these eras usually last. And there are a couple reasons for that. One is that the federal government made some important changes around 1980, but none after that. It encouraged universities to work more closely with industry. And the Bayh-Dole Act encouraged universities to patent inventions. There were other government programs. And these programs had an immediate effect, reorienting university research. But they had a longer-term effect in showing that university research was an important contributor to economic development. Now, that had not been the belief in the 1970s. But after 1980, this became more and more evident. And as a result, Congress kept funding academic research fairly generously. Of course, people in universities never admit that, but there's been an awful lot of funding going into academic research. And the result has been spectacular. American universities lead the world by a large margin in innovation and academic progress. The other thing was the origins of the loan culture. And the change in funding higher education, that's the switch from government funding to individual funding. At the end of the 70s, state support for public higher education was higher than at any previous period, even though the 70s was a very difficult decade. But after this economic upheaval of 1979 through 81, 82, states basically cut back on their funding for higher education and have been doing so ever since. I liken it to a roller coaster. The overall direction of a roller coaster is down. You go up and down and up and down, but you end up going mainly down. And that's what's happened with state funding. And it's been replaced by federal financing through individuals. And now the largest source of money for higher education is government money given to individuals to pay for college. Pell grants and loans and income tax exemptions are the largest sources, with loans being by far larger than anything else. So now that's the way we finance higher education, and that's a complete change over the last 40 years.
There's a lot more assessment of all education in the country right now, including public universities, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. It's hard to show any evidence that it's been effective. Learning in colleges is received a lot of publicity as being substandard, not what we would like it to be. That's really only a half-truth. I mean, the problem is that 70% of high school students are now attending some form of higher education, but only half of them have the academic preparation needed for college-level work. So as a result, only about 50% of them actually graduate. Actually, the graduation rate for students who enter four-year institutions is nearly 60%, but that's not very good. There have been a number of studies to show that students really aren't learning very much. Certainly, they're spending much less time on their studies than they did 40 or 50 years ago, and that's been proven by surveys. But there's another side of this. There are a lot of students who are still going to college, going to class, doing their readings, and graduating and doing very well. Students in STEM fields have to learn the material. You can't fake it in calculus class.
I can confirm that, by the way.
A lot of us could.
Yeah.
And the highly selective institutions provide a good education, not rigorous, but students tend to benefit from it and go on to graduate professional schools. Students who want to go on to graduate professional schools have to get good grades, of course. And honors programs are thriving. Undergraduate research programs keep growing. So these students are getting a very good education out of our very good universities.
Some of those students, though, who aren't getting in there, is that where the for-profit colleges swoop in?
I don't think so. That's a different population. Basically, the system of financing through federal grants and loans made possible the growth of these corporate universities. And they were really a pathological phenomenon. They hired recruiters and spent most of their largest part of their budgets on marketing to get students to sign up. Their slogan was no out-of-pocket expenses, because everything was covered by Pell grants and loans. But of course, these students are then stuck having to pay back their loans, which a large proportion of them could not do. They really went after a different population. Students who had dropped out of high school or not done very well, they really go after servicemen. So in that sense, there was sort of this great rise of for-profit enrollments in the first decade of the 21st century tapped a different population and, in my opinion, did not do them a favor. Government regulation has made it more difficult to do that, and they keep changing their tactics, and their enrollments have gone down considerably.
Well, look ahead. When you or someone very much like you writes a book about American higher education 50 years from now, is it going to be a hopeful book?
Well, you know, people who write about higher education always look at the dark side. You know, we always try to find what's not working and what deserves to be criticized. That's why writing this, I had to, you know, sort of pinch myself at times and say, well, look at all those students who are in honors programs and who are doing undergraduate research, and look at the great contribution of American universities. So I think the academic leadership of American universities is very solidly based. And I hope we'll keep us near the top for another 50 years. For the rest of the system, the kind of bifurcation that has occurred is very troubling. The highly selective institutions are, you know, increasingly the province of the upper middle class and the upper class. They're charging $70,000 a year right now, and it goes up every year. So it's hard to imagine how that can change very much. So this bifurcating trend is very disturbing. You know, it seems to be accompanied by a lack of investment in the regional state colleges and the community colleges where the majority of Americans are attending. So they derive some benefit from this, but probably not as many graduate as should graduate, and they're probably not being taught as much as they could be. So those are negative trends. But universities are doing well, and universities are doing so many things that they just seem to be getting bigger and better. It's a sort of kind of a question of whether they can keep doing such a variety of tasks.
Again, the name of Professor Roger Geiger's new book is American Higher Education Since World War II, A History. It's published by Princeton University Press. The New York State Department of Education has approved a new dual-degree nursing program between two colleges in the state. The best of our knowledge is Jesse King has that story.
The new four-year, 122-credit program will grant students an Associate of Science in Nursing from Maria College in Albany and a Bachelor of Science in Nursing from nearby Siena College upon graduation. Dr. Lisa Lally Flack, Director of Nursing at Siena, says students will spend their first year at the Loudonville campus for prerequisites like human anatomy and physiology before making the 15-minute commute to Maria College for the next 2 years.
So they're at Maria College taking all the pre-licensure courses, but layered on top of that, we also have the upper division nursing classes. So at the end of that junior year, they've earned the associate's degree, and they sit for the NCLEX. When they come back as seniors, they finish up their upper division nursing and any core that's remaining for the bachelor's.
The NCLEX is the National Council Licensure Exam, which every student must pass in order to become a registered nurse. At Maria College, students will have access to simulation labs at its newly upgraded Macaulay Teaching Facility and participate in clinical rotations at hospitals around the Capital Region. Maria College President Dr. Thomas Gamble says the school, which is sponsored by the Sisters of Mercy of the Americas, has been training nurses for 50 years.
But that is successor to a 70-year history of the program at St. Peter's Hospital. So it's 120 years of mercy-inspired nursing education that we bring to the table.
But aside from access to multiple facilities, why apply for a dual-degree program? In a later interview, Flack said the junior year NCLEX exam is part of what makes the new partnership stand out. While some hospitals continue the old practice of hiring nurses-to-be shortly before the exam, she says many aren't willing to take the risk.
Now they're waiting until they have that NCLEX completed successfully before hiring. So our nursing students in these programs will be able to go out in the spring of their senior year and be first out of the gate, really, to get these jobs.
According to the BSN and 10 law signed by Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo in 2017, nurses looking to enter the field in New York must acquire a Bachelor of Science in Nursing within 10 years of passing the NCLEX. And while both Siena and Maria offer RN to BSN programs for working nurses looking to complete that requirement, Flack says dual degree programs are much more convenient for new students. Siena established a similar partnership with the Belanger School of Nursing at Ellis Hospital in Schenectady in 2017, and Flack says it's full, with over 130 students.
That program is primarily filled with our first-time freshmen coming in, so out of high school. The new Maria program I see as filling the need of our internal and external transfer students that are seeking nursing, whether perhaps they have a different major or they're coming from another school, and it's a way for them to get into nursing at Siena with a Maria program.
Experts have warned of a growing national nursing shortage as the baby boomers continue aging. The new program currently has 8 students, and interim Siena president Dr. Margaret Madden says she's happy to see it start accepting applications in earnest. The launch is also bittersweet, she says, as the program was close to the heart of late President Brother Edward Coghlan, who died suddenly in July at age 71.
And I'm particularly sorry that he's not here for this, because he worked closely with President Gamble to inspire this program. And he was keenly interested in its progress towards approval. So I'm thinking of Brother Ed here and knowing that he's smiling on this occasion.
Both private colleges are nationally accredited for their individual nursing programs. Founded in 1937 in the Franciscan and Catholic tradition, Siena College has 40 majors and more than 3,000 students. Maria College serves nearly 800 students at its campus in Albany. Reporting from Loudonville, I'm Jesse King.
An apology is an apology unless it's really not. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The best strategy for a public apology is not always followed. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Lisa Leopold, associate professor of English language studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, discusses the best way to say sorry.
What makes an apology sincere, and why is it so difficult for public figures to get apologies right? A public apology is a high-stakes affair and issued to a diverse audience who may have very different conceptions of what makes an apology effective. Research shows that well-executed apologies have the potential to improve relationships, the financial performance of companies, and one's public reputation. From my analysis of dozens of recent public apologies, drawing upon insights from linguists, psychologists, and business ethicists, I have found that apologies tend to fare better when they include 3 strategies: an actual apology, ownership for the offense, and an expression of empathy. Not all apologies are created equal. Public figures weaken the actual apology when they fail to explicitly name the transgression and instead use a euphemism for their wrongdoing, apologize for a lesser rather than the main offense, address an unrelated topic in the apology, or use the word but to justify their actions. Furthermore, when public figures use the passive voice, include themselves as part of a larger group at fault, or recontextualize their bad behavior as acceptable in a different time, they weaken ownership for the offense. When public figures emphasize that the pain caused was unintentional, give excuses for their bad behavior, or frame the apology using a conditional or a modal, they weaken expressions of empathy. However, public figures who apologize for a specific transgression, claim ownership for their wrongdoing, and express genuine empathy tend to fare better than those whose apologies do not.
That was Lisa Leopold of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.